Mark O'Connor is widely regarded as one of the most versatile musicians of modern times. He is a violinist, fiddle champion, composer, educator, and, at least in the 70s, a rock star. His playing styles encompass virtually all genres, including bluegrass, jazz, classical, and country, to name just a few. But he also fuses those styles together in his own compositions and improvisations to create music that's entirely new, but distinctly American. He's won many awards, including 2 Grammys and 8 nominations, was named Musician of the Year by the Country Music Association 6 years in a row, and won 7 National and Grandmaster Fiddling Championships, the first time at the age of 14. As a composer, he has written works in every form, including concertos, symphonies, chamber works, and even a few choral works. And he is performing one of his own compositions with the Oak Ridge Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night. Premiered just a few years ago, O'Connor's improvised concerto is a melding of improvised and notated music. The orchestral parts are completely written out while O'Connor, on the solo violin, improvises for a full 40 minutes. As a result, every performance is a unique experience. O'Connor will also perform his Strings and Thread Suite, and the Oak Ridge Symphony will perform Zoltán Kodály's Dances of Galanta. The concert begins at 7:30 p.m. Saturday evening and will be given at the Oak Ridge High School Performing Arts Center. A few days ago, I spoke with Mr. O'Connor by phone and learned a little bit about his early days of playing and his philosophies on stylistic differences in music and how they are taught. We also discussed his improvised concerto as well as the skill of improvisation in general. Mark O'Connor, is truly such an honor and a thrill to speak with you today. Thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here soon with the Oak Ridge Symphony and perform my music.
Absolutely. I'd first love to hear how it all began. How did you come to choose the violin as your instrument? Because if I understand correctly, it wasn't the first instrument that you started on.
Yeah, the guitar was the very first instrument that I began on. And it wasn't until I was 11 that I found the violin and it became my principal instrument and the one that I created so much music for over the years. And I began writing music for the violin very early on. And it's those compositions that I'll be performing with the orchestra.
Do you remember the first time that you held a violin?
Yes, I do. I remember because I was 11. I was kind of a little bit older for a beginning violin student. It was because I had already spent 6 or 7 years on the guitar. And so I remember my very first lessons and the feeling that I had when I first played. I remember, picking something out from my one of my fiddle heroes, Doug Kershaw, on one string before I had my first lesson. And so it was all an incredible journey right from the beginning.
Did it feel like magic from the start? Like it just belonged in your hands?
Yeah, I think so. I remember telling my mother that it was something that I wanted to be able to communicate through, communicate to audiences with and people around me. I felt like it was an emotional extension of what I was thinking and dreaming and envisioning for myself as a person. So there was, right from the very beginning, creativity was foremost on my mind. I wanted to become technically good, but at the same time, I wanted to have individualism and expression and improvisation and the diversity of styles and culture seep through my violin, like as if I was speaking to someone that I cared about.
That was actually my next question. You seem to have began studying all of those styles right from the very beginning. So is that something that you sought out and immediately just hungered for?
Yeah. I loved the feeling of being able to experience different styles of music. And going from one style to the next seemed to energize me. It wasn't like a laborious process, like, I have to learn this new style. It was actually more like the idea that one feeds the other. And there was this incredible pathway that, with all its twists and turns, that you picked up new ingredients along the way rather than just do one thing and have it become bland. All the different cultural diversity of American styles represented all the beautiful spices and flavors that that make music so engaging and interesting. And my curiosity was just, you know, really up for it. And the American music seemed to be the platform for which I was really able to experience this kind of expression.
Does it require different techniques to play these different styles?
Yeah, it does. The techniques involved in any style or direction of music is something that you learn along with that music. One technique doesn't necessarily get you the other style.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly if you create an environment to learn when you're a child through musical language, you assimilate the techniques. And I think the musical language is a powerful part of my own message for music education. Musical language is assimilated much more quickly when you're a child. So the techniques go hand in hand with those styles and that language. And it becomes less laborious, less about scales and more about discovery and creativity.
When did you begin composing?
I was 13 when I wrote my first pieces. I was 12 when I really seriously began to arrange folk music materials in my own style or my own approach. So, you know, then I got the bug for it, and I kept it going. And you know, by the time I was 16, my albums, my recordings, featured mostly my original material at that point. So my original composition became a big focus of my output, and therefore the biggest component for my success as an artist.
Where do you typically get your inspiration when composing? How did those first few ideas form in your head?
Well, the first idea is in many cases the biggest one, because it gets you started. It gives you a platform for which to launch your project. So in my thinking, the initial idea is the biggest hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get that idea going, then you have a number of options how to treat that idea. And those options develop over time. It comes with, you know, experience and ability and technical applications, depending on the instrumentation. So for instance, if I get a really neat idea musically, then my next job is to figure out, you know, what context is this going to be in? Is this a motive for a small ensemble, a big ensemble, an orchestra?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if I really need to, you know, compose an orchestral piece and I get another idea for some other kind of piece, I'll have to put it aside for the time being and maybe return to it when I'm ready.
You are performing your improvised concerto with the Oak Ridge Symphony this weekend. Tell us about this work. What exactly is improvised?
The entire lead line on the violin is improvised on stage. Every time I rehearse it, practice it, or perform it, the entire thing is made up from the first note to the last note. And nothing's been done like this in the history of classical music or concerto performing or writing. And it is really, really an interesting project. I thought of an idea of how to introduce a new idea for a concerto with the fact that I had the fiddle concerto for the first time as a really bold and new idea from 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came time to write my ninth concerto, which was, you know, 20 years later, I'd done a lot of work with different instrumentation. I was thinking of a new idea that was perhaps as bold and new as the fiddle concerto was. The fiddle concerto was the first time that American fiddling was brought front and center to the concerto form in terms of not just thematic ideas, but stylistic, musical language, and technical ideas to drive the solo violin in the piece. With the improvised violin concerto, you could say it's as new and bold as that fiddle concerto was, in that the improvisation, the idea that you're inventing the solo line on stage while the orchestration is reading, you know, from my scores, mm-hmm. is also a brand new direction in composition.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about improvisation? Because I think perhaps to most listeners, it often appears effortless, as if the music just kind of comes to the performer somehow. But there's actually quite a bit of thought and knowledge that's required of the improviser. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So even musicians that do not improvise, some of them miscalculate in thinking or imagining that somehow improvisation is about letting go or relaxing or just, you know, kind of like dreaming. Or now there's certain aspects that incorporate that type of thinking, but one can't forget the discipline that it requires to be thinking about rhythm and chord changes and harmonic movement and doing all of that while making up new notes and keeping with the ensemble and playing as if this was written that way.
Right.
So the idea that the brain is hyped up and thinking a mile a minute is accurate. I mean, that would be what's happening. It's like hyper-focus. In some ways, since I've been improvising since I was a child, it is fairly natural for me to do. It doesn't mean that it's not taxing or it takes a lot of commitment and focus. It does, but I'm sort of just, you know, sort of used to focusing like that.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the premiere of this work. I understand that it was with a youth symphony.
Yes, it was premiered and commissioned by the Boston Youth Symphony Orchestras and premiered in Boston Symphony Hall just about 3 years ago. We have a film of that we feature on a CD, DVD, and also on YouTube on the websites mm-hmm. that people can see and hear. And it was a lucky film. It was the first time I ever done it, and it was done really well. And I'm really glad we decided to film that first performance. But yeah, I think that the orchestration that I used is very exciting, in a kind of like a new rock energy, classical direction. There's lots of rhythmic motives from the string playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also use some electronic pedals in the electric violin to give me new sound colors and ideas to improvise with. So I've got a bit more of a palette of sound and color and texture to draw on when I'm improvising. So I'm improvising all that as well. So I'm not just improvising notes, but I'm improvising whether it's electric or acoustic on any given measure.
Could your concerto be performed by other solo violinists or other solo instruments for that matter?
It could. My improvised violin concerto, any number of instruments could be the solo instrument, in fact. And other violinists could do, you know, what I'm doing. Not very many, probably because of the training mm-hmm. and preparation involved. That's one of my soapbox messages is that we should be training classical violinists to be able to improvise and write some of their own music as well in universities and conservatories. And, you know, my message also says that we should be doing this earlier, much earlier than college level. Because by the time, if you wait until college, I have a huge advantage on them. I started writing music when I was 13 and improvising when I was 12. So, you know, why wait to get into college before you first look at some of these important aspects of music making? I've been able to use the improvised violin concerto as a great example of what could happen if there were more creative violinists thinking about new ideas and new approaches to performance in classical music.
You just mentioned your instructional string method, the O'Connor method, that you developed as an alternative to other teaching methods, I suppose, such as Suzuki, for example. Tell us more about your method. How is it different or similar to others?
Well, one of the main things that I wanted to try to accomplish is to help create an American school of string playing. I would love for my method to be considered, you know, at least a centerpiece in that effort. It certainly does not disclude other approaches in the American string playing approach. Matter of fact, there are wonderful examples of American string teaching, including from my own teachers. Benny Thomason was one of the greatest fiddle teachers many of his students had ever known, so including myself. But what I really want to do is to formalize an approach to learning the violin using American music, American culture, and philosophies of learning, which include a bunch of things that are just certainly not covered in the Suzuki tradition. So American music, just by its nature, includes rhythm, for instance, ensemble band playing. Of course, it includes the styles that are being left out of current violin pedagogy, like jazz, like American fiddling. It includes creativity, includes tune writing. I want to encourage children to not only learn the tunes in the book, but to eventually create tunes themselves. The way I operate as a violinist is completely creative when you take a look at the current conservatory models of formal training for violin. And, you know, and it's a shame because I can play all the scales and the techniques that many can, but I've got this whole other opportunity to create music, to write music, and add to our repertoire, add to our literature, which I think is important for musicians to do with every generation. Mm-hmm. If we don't do that, then our repertoire becomes ultimately depleted, and it's not going to be, the string world is not going to be as exciting as it once was. Mm-hmm. You could even make a case for that as we speak. It's becoming less and less exciting compared to, say, the 1950s or the 1920s or especially the 19th century. So that's part of the big part of my message is to create relevance. What does string playing mean for the 21st century? And creating relevance to our culture, using our history, but also looking forward, putting musicians in an empowering position rather than a subservient one to pre-existing literature only. It's up to the musicians to lead and to create new repertoire.
Do you feel like the lines dividing classical, jazz, bluegrass, and other styles of music are finally starting to blur?
You know, I've long wanted that. I believe that we are stronger when we come together. And it's the American way. It's the American system. It's how this country was settled. It's what our philosophy is for living, for learning. For the violin not to absolutely mirror these ideals that we've worked so hard on in this country and this part of the world and the world over, in fact. It has a lot to do with freedom, learning to be curious about our neighbors and wanting to come together and work together and play together. So the violin, I think, for it to go forward, needs to really look at what we do best, especially in this country, and is to unite. And for different camps to shut out, you know, the other thing is elitism, you know, classism, racism, all the isms. Mm. And we've been through all that, and we don't really need that anymore. What we want to do is offer wonderful opportunities for people to learn and have a choice. And what I'd like to see is violin programs in universities where you can show up and learn some Beethoven and Bach, and also learn some bluegrass and learn some jazz, and have those teachers there promote that and not just allow that, but nurture that type of learning and participate in it and encourage the next generation to be more inclusive rather than exclusive. I think the exclusive approach that we've been taking for violin is starting to shut us out of opportunities as a violin and string playing culture. And we need everybody. We need great classical soloists, but we need great classical violin composers and improvisers and band leaders and people with ideas. Who are the violinists that are going to really integrate the violin with hip-hop music, with rock, going forward and bring all of this in? We can't just leave it up to the keyboard players, or the guitar players. The violin has to take its place at the table. And in order to do that, we need violin players that are thinking, that can create opportunities musically, technically, creatively, and apply those things for everyone to follow, to be inspired by.
One final question. Have you performed in Oak Ridge before?
You know, it's been a long, long time. My friend and longtime colleague, Edgar Meyer, is from Oak Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
And we've often talked about his home place. And so that's going to be really wonderful to be in his home neck of the woods. Of course, he lives in Nashville now. But I really look forward to it. My guest, Maggie Dixon, is a wonderful violinist that is going to perform a duo with me in the concert, Strings and Threads Suite. And it's a conversation between two violins and orchestra. And she's an amazing violinist. You mentioned before about blurring those boundaries. She's a, you know, a classical violinist and American fiddler. And she cross-pollinates between those two things and blurs the lines, much like how I'm doing from a creative standpoint with my writing and composing. So it's so another example of how this works, and the audiences will really enjoy our performance, I'm sure.
Oh, and so that will be performed on the concert as well.
Yes, that will be an added piece of Strings and Threads Suite.
Wonderful.
The actual music is something that I wrote years ago. It's sort of follows my family tree line, and it looks at the development of folk music in America. And so to have that conversation with two violins, opening it up in a new way, has been really exciting for me this year. And Maggie's playing is just beautiful on it.
Well, Mr. O'Connor, it was indeed a true pleasure talking with you. Thank you again, and best of luck at the concert.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, and I look forward to being there in a few days.
That was violinist and composer Mark O'Connor, who was performing his innovative improvised concerto with the Oak Ridge Symphony this Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. He's also performing his Strings and Threads Suite, and the symphony will present Zoltán Kodály's Dances of Galanta. The concert, as always, will be given at the Oak Ridge High School Performing Arts Center. More information on this event can be found online at orcma.org or by phone at 483-5569.